Chapter 31. Vaughn revisited Artists Hall in 1888. He arrived on a cloudy June afternoon, unexpected, unbidden, unneeded, with a diamond necklace coiled loose in his pocket. As he approached from a side lawn, he saw a scene out of some new life being rehearsed for an unknown picture. Without him. Not for him. A big party seemed to be breaking up. Three young ladies in yellow-blue Vaas frocks with fashionable rainbow sashes surrounded a stoutish, foppish, baldish young man who stood, a flute of champagne in his hand, glancing down from the drawing-room terrace at a girl in black with bare arms. An old runabout, shivering at every jerk, was being cranked up by a hoary chauffeur in front of the porch, and those bare arms, stretched wide, were holding outspread the white cape of Baroness von Skull, a grand aunt of hers. Against the white cape, Ada's new long figure was profiled in black, the black of her smart silk dress with no sleeves, no ornaments, no memories. The slow old Baroness stood groping for something under one armpit, under the other. For what? A crutch? The dangling end of tangled bangles? And as she half turned to accept the cloak, now taken from her grandniece by a belated new footman, Ada also half turned, and her yet ungemmed neck showed white as she ran up the porch steps. Vaughn followed her inside, in between the hall columns and through a group of guests toward a distant table with crystal jugs of cherry ambrosia. She wore, unmodishly, no stockings. Her calves were strong and pale, and, I have a note here for the ghost of a novel, the low cut of her black dress allowed the establishment of a sharp contrast between the familiar matte whiteness of her skin and the brutal black horsetail of her new hairdo. Excluding each other, private swoons split him in two, the devastating certainty that as soon as he reached, in the labyrinth of a nightmare, a brightly remembered small room with a bed and a child's washstand, she would join him there in her new, smooth, long beauty. And, on the shade side, the pang and panic of finding her changed, hating what he wanted, condemning it as wrong, explaining to him dreadful new circumstances, that they both were dead, or existed only as extras in a house rented for a motion picture. But hands offering him wine or almonds or their open selves impeded his dream quest. He pressed on, notwithstanding the swoops of recognition. Uncle Dan pointed him out with a cry to a stranger who feigned amazement at the singularity of the optical trick, and next moment, a repainted, red-wigged, very drunk and tearful Marina was gluing cherry vodka lips to his jaw and unprotected parts, with smothered mother sounds, half moo, half moan, of Russian affection. He disentangled himself and pursued his quest. She had now moved to the drawing room, but by the expression of her back, by the tensed scapulae, Vaughn knew she was aware of him. He wiped his wet, buzzing ear and acknowledged with a nod the raised glass of the stout blonde fellow. Percy Dupré? Or did Percy have an older brother? A fourth maiden in the Canadian couturier's corn and bluette summer creation stopped Vaughn to inform him with a pretty pout that he did not remember her, which was true. "I am exhausted," he said. "My horse caught a hoof in a hole in the rotting planks of Lodore Bridge and had to be shot. I have walked 8 miles. I think I am dreaming. I think you are dreaming too."
"No, I'm Cordula," she cried,
but he was off again. Ada had vanished. He discarded the caviar sandwich that he found himself carrying like a ticket and, turning into the pantry, told Boots' brother, a new valet, to take him to his old room and get him one of those rubber tubs he had used as a child 4 years ago, plus somebody's spare pajamas. His train had broken down in the fields between Ladoga and Lodore. He had walked 20 miles, God knows, when they'd sent up his bags.
"They have just come," said the real Boot, with a smile both confidential and mournful.
Blanche had jilted him. Before tubbing, Van craned out of his narrow casement to catch sight of the laurels and lilacs flanking the front porch, whence came the hubbub of gay departures. He made out Ada. He noticed her running after Percy, who had put on his gray topper and was walking away across a lawn, which his transit at once caused to overlap in Van's mind with the fleeting memory of the paddock where he and Van had once happened to discuss a lame horse and River Lane. Ada overtook the young man in a patch of sudden sunlight. He stopped, and she stood speaking to him, and tossing her head in a way she had when nervous or displeased. Depré kissed her hand. That was French, but all right. He held the hand he had kissed while she spoke, and then kissed it again. And that was not done. That was dreadful. That could not be endured. Leaving his post, naked Vaughn went through the clothes he had shed. He found the necklace. In icy fury, he tore it into 30, 40 glittering hailstones, some of which fell at her feet as she burst into the room. Her glance swept the floor.
"What a shame," she began.
Vaughn calmly quoted the punchline from Mademoiselle La Riviere's famous story,
"Mais, ma pauvre amie, elle était fausse,"
which was a bitter lie. But before picking up the spilled diamonds, she locked the door and embraced him, weeping. The touch of her skin and silk was all the magic of life. "But why does everybody greet me with tears?" He also wanted to know, was that Percy Depré? It was. Who had been kicked out of River Lane? She guessed he had. He had changed. He had grown swine stout. He had. Hadn't he just? Was he her new beau?
"And now," said Ada, "Van is going to stop being vulgar. I mean stop forever. Because I had and have and shall always have only one beau, only one beast, only one sorrow, only one joy."
"We can collect your tears later," he said. "I can't wait." Her open kiss was hot and tremulous, but when he tried to draw up her dress, she flinched with a murmur of reluctant denial, because the door had come alive. Two small fists could be heard drumming upon it from the outside in a rhythm both knew well. "Hi, Lucette," cried Vaughn. "I'm changing. Go away."
"Hi, Vaughn. They want Ada, not you. They want you downstairs, Ada."
One of Ada's gestures, used when she had to express in a muted flash all the facets of her predicament.
"See? I was right. That's how it is. Ничего не подалаешь,"
consisted of rounding by means of both hands an invisible bowl from rim to base, accompanied by a sad bow. This is what she did now, before leaving the room. The situation was repeated in a much more pleasing strain a few hours later. For supper, Ada wore another dress of crimson cotton, and when they met at night, in the old tool room by the glow of a carbide lantern, he unzipped her with such impetuous force that he nearly tore it in two to expose her entire beauty. They were still fiercely engaged, on the same bench covered with the same tartan lap robe, thoughtfully brought, when the outside door noiselessly opened and Blanche glided in like an imprudent ghost. She had her own key, was back from a rendezvous with old Soar, the Burgundian night watchman, and stopped like a fool gaping at the young couple. "Knock next time," said Vaughn with a grin, not bothering to pause, rather enjoying, in fact, the bewitching apparition. She wore a miniver cloak that Ada had lost in the woods.
Oh, she had become wonderfully pretty, and elle le mangeait des yeux.
But Ada slammed the lantern shut, and with apologetic groans, the slut groped her way to the inner passage. His true love could not help giggling, and Vaughn resumed his passionate task. They stayed on and on, quite unable to part, knowing any explanation would do if anybody wondered why their rooms had remained empty till dawn. The first ray of the morning dabbed a toolbox with fresh green paint when, at last moved by hunger, they got up and quietly repaired to the pantry.
Что виспался, Ван?
Well, slept your fill, Ван? Said Ada, beautifully mimicking her mother's voice, and she continued in her mother's English,
By your appetite, I judge, and I think it is only the first breakfast.
Oh, grumbled Ван, my kneecaps. That bench was cruel, and I am hungry. They sat, facing each other, at a breakfast table, munching black bread with fresh butter and Virginia ham and slices of genuine Emmentaler cheese. And here's a pot of transparent honey, two cheerful cousins raiding the icebox as children in old fairy tales. And the thrushes were sweetly whistling in the bright green garden as the dark green shadows drew in their claws.
My teacher, she said, at the drama school, thinks I'm better in farces than in tragedy. If they only knew.
There is nothing to know, retorted Ван. Nothing has changed. But that's the general impression. It was too dim down there for details. We'll examine them tomorrow on our little island. My sister, do you still recall?
Oh, shut up, said Ada. I've given up all that stuff. Petit verre, verre de soie.
Come, cried Ван.
Some of the rhymes were magnificent acrobatics on the part of the child's mind. Oh, qui me rendra ma Lucille, et le grand chêne and ze big heel?
Little Lucille, he added in an effort to dissipate her frowns with a joke, little Lucille has become so peachy that I think I'll switch over to her if you keep losing your temper like that. I remember the first time you got cross with me was when I chucked a stone at a statue and frightened a finch. That's memory. She was on bad terms with memory. She thought the servants would be up soon now, and then one could have something hot. That fridge was all fudge, really.
Why suddenly sad?
Yes, she was sad, she replied. She was in dreadful trouble. Her quandary might drive her insane if she did not know that her heart was pure. She could explain it best by a parable. She was like the girl in a film he would see soon, who is in the triple throes of a tragedy which she must conceal lest she lose her only true love, the head of the arrow, the point of the pain. In secret, she is simultaneously struggling with three torments— trying to get rid of a dreary, dragging affair with a married man whom she pities, trying to nip in the bud, in the sticky, red bud, a crazy adventure with an attractive young fool whom she pities even more, and trying to keep intact the love of the only man who is all her life and who is above pity, above the poverty of her feminine pity, because, as the script says, his ego is richer and prouder than anything those two poor worms could imagine.
What had she actually done with the poor worms after Krolik's untimely end? Oh, set them free.
Big, vague gesture.
Turn them out. Put them back onto suitable plants. Buried them in the pupal state. Told them to run along while the birds were not looking. Or, alas, feigning not to be looking. Well, to mop up that parable, because you have the knack of interrupting and diverting my thoughts, I'm in a sense also torn between three private tortures, the main torture being ambition, of course. I know I shall never be a biologist. My passion for creeping creatures is great, but not all-consuming. I know I shall always adore orchids and mushrooms and violets, and you will still see me going out alone, to wander alone in the woods and return alone with a little lone lily. But flowers, no matter how irresistible, must be given up too, as soon as I have the strength. Remains the great ambition and the greatest terror, the dream of the bluest, remotest, hardest dramatic climbs, probably ending as one of 100 old spider spinsters teaching drama students, knowing that, as you insist, sinister insister, we can't marry. And having always before me the awful example of pathetic, second-rate, brave Marina.
Well, that bit about spinsters is rot, said Vaughn. We'll pull it off somehow. We'll become more and more distant relations in artistically forged papers and finally dwindle to mere namesakes. Or at the worst, we shall live quietly, you as my housekeeper, I as your epileptic, and then, as in your Chekhov, we shall see the whole sky swarm with diamonds.
Did you find them all, Uncle Vaughn?
She inquired, sighing, laying her dolent head on his shoulder. She had told him everything. More or less, he replied, not realizing she had. Anyway, I made the best study of the dustiest floor ever accomplished by a romantic character. One bright little bugger rolled under the bed where there grows a virgin forest of fluff and fungi. I'll have them reassembled in Lodore when I motor there one of these days. I have lots of things to buy. A gorgeous bathrobe in honor of your new swimming pool, a cream called chrysanthemum, a brace of dueling pistols, a folding beach mattress, preferably black, to bring you out not on the beach, but on that bench and on our Ile de l'Ador. Except, she said, that I do not approve of your making a laughing stock of yourself by looking for pistols in souvenir shops, especially when Ardis Hall is full of old shotguns and rifles and revolvers and bows and arrows. You remember, we had lots of practice with them when you and I were children.
Oh, he did. He did. Children, yes. In point of fact, how puzzling to keep seeing that recent past in nursery terms. Because nothing had changed. You are with me, aren't you? Nothing. Not counting little improvements in the grounds and the governess.
Yes, wasn't that a scream? La Riviere blossoming forth as a great writer. A sensational Canadian best-selling author. Her story, The Necklace, La Riviere des Diamants, had become a classic in girls' schools, and her gorgeous pseudonym, Guillaume de Montparnasse, the leaving out of the T made it more intime, was well known from Quebec to Kaluga. As she put it in her exotic English, fame struck, and the rubles rolled, and the dollars poured, both currencies being used at the time in East Estotiland. But good Ida, far from abandoning Marina, with whom she had been platonically and irrevocably in love ever since she had seen her in Bilitis, accused herself of neglecting Lucette by overindulging in literature. Consequently, she now gave the child, in spurts of vacational zeal, considerably more attention than poor little Ida, said Ida, had received at 12, after her first miserable term at school. Vaughn had been such an idiot, suspecting Cordula, chaste, gentle, dumb little Cordula de Pré, when Ada had explained to him twice, thrice, in different codes, that she had invented a nasty, tender schoolmate at a time when she had been literally torn from him and only assumed in advance, so to speak, such a girl's existence. A kind of blank check that she wanted from him.
Well, you got it, said Vaughn, but now it's destroyed and will not be renewed.
But why did you run after Fat Percy? What was so important?
Oh, very important, said Ada, catching a drop of honey on her nether lip. His mother was on the Dorophone, and he said please tell her he was on his way home, and I forgot all about it, and rushed up to kiss you.
At River Lane, said Vaughn. We used to call that a donut truth. Only the truth, and the whole truth, with a hole in the truth.
I hate you, cried Ada, and made what she called a warning frog face, because Bouteillon had appeared in the doorway, his mustache shaved
coatless, tieless, in crimson braces that were holding up to his chest his well-filled black trousers. He disappeared, promising to bring them their coffee.
But let me ask you, dear Van, let me ask you something. How many times has Van been unfaithful to me since September 1884?
613 times, answered Van, with at least 200 whores who only caressed me. I've remained absolutely true to you because those were only ob manipulations, sham, insignificant strokings by unremembered cold hands. The butler, now fully dressed, arrived with the coffee and toast and the Lador Gazette. It contained a picture of Marina being fawned upon by a young Latin actor.
"Pah!" exclaimed Ada. "I had quite forgotten. He's coming today with a movie man, and our afternoon will be ruined. But I feel refreshed and fit."
She added, after a third cup of coffee,
"It is only 7:10 now. We shall go for a nice stroll in the park. There are one or two places that you might recognize."
"My love," said Vaughn, "my phantom orchid, my lovely bladder senna. I have not slept for 2 nights, one of which I spent imagining the other, and this other turned out to be more than I had imagined. I've had enough of you for the time being."
"Not a very fine compliment," said Ada, and rang resonantly for more toast.
"I've paid you 8 compliments at a certain Venetian..."
"I'm not interested in vulgar Venetians. You have become so coarse, dear Van, so strange."
"Sorry," he said, getting up. "I don't know what I'm saying. I'm dead tired. I'll see you at lunch."
"There will be no lunch today," said Ada. "It will be some messy snack at the poolside and sticky drinks all day."
He wanted to kiss her on her silky head, but Bouteillin at that moment came in, and while Ada was crossly rebuking him for the meager supply of toast, Van escaped.